All of this begins with you as practitioners and me as a practitioner accepting or rejecting four postulations, which I think underlie everything we know about public relations today. First of all, is the question of what does public relations aim at? What sort of raw material are we working with? For a long time, we have said that we deal in opinion, public opinion. Seems to me that's hopelessly outdated. The phrase public opinion is one of those great cliches of our nation, and let's hope it remains such. But opinion itself, as a workable entity, is really pretty useless. The reason being that it changes so fast. You know, on Monday you're going to vote for Joe, and by Wednesday it's Susie, and by Friday you're probably not going to vote at all because all the candidates seem hopeless. If that isn't what we're after, simply because you can't get a handle on it, what are we after? Well, after we frogged around with that for a while, we said, we have new sophistication. We're going to go now for attitudes. Well, as a consultant, I love it when a client says, we want an attitude change campaign, because the best we know is that it takes about 15 years to alter them. And of course, I love that kind of contract. We soon realize that attitudes themselves are not as stable as we thought. At the American Association of Public Opinion Research, the APOR conference last week, there were several presentations on how attitudes now are changing pretty rapidly. Maybe it doesn't take 15 years anymore, or even if it takes 15 years, the behaviorist psychologists have taught us that attitudes no longer lead to behavior. You know, my attitude about my Weight Watchers program is excellent. I really want to. But my behavior toward my Weight Watchers is something else. So pretty soon we say, well, you can't really measure what we do by that either. What then is the bottom line? It seems to me we have to accept the very hard postulation that we are in the behavior motivation, behavior modification business. If you can't measure it in people's behavior, what good is it? Oh, I know, they have the right attitudes and they're going to. Well, listen, I founded the Going To Club, so don't tell me about that stuff. Because it's all out there, some other day. When Roger Smith took over as chairman of General Motors, you know, when all kings come to the throne, they get a chance to give a speech. And remember, General Motors is sort of a throne. It's the 13th largest nation in the world. That's right, only 12 nations have more annual generation of cash, of income, than General Motors. So when Roger took over as king, he gave a little speech to let the troops know the themes of his administration. And what he said was very simple. He said, I don't care if people love our cars. The only question is, are they buying our cars? In short, we're going to measure it on behavior, on sales this year, or sales that you can pretty well convince me are right there the first quarter of next year. Not that, you know, gee, somewhere off in the far future. Now, this is tough. This is tough. But IBM, 3 years ago, began evaluating its public relations department by their ability to prove a linkage to a number of very specific things, a linkage to actual sales, a linkage to issues which were deflected and therefore did not cost the company a lot of money and lost effort to deal with. And sure, it's tough sometimes to prove those specifically, but the point is people are demanding that we start doing it. And it isn't all that difficult for us if we start out thinking behavior is what we're after. We want people to behave in one of three ways. We want them to do something, we want them not to do something, or we want them to let the organization do something. Those three kinds of behaviors. So that's the first postulation. If you can accept that that is true, then I think you begin to see quickly why research is so essential, because the room for guesswork is reduced, greatly reduced. But remember, the benefits are outstanding, because the number one criticism of us and our calling has been, well, it's all that soft PR stuff. Nothing soft about that. Nothing soft at all. When we deal with a client that's having some kind of problem inside the organization, And we're counseling them on using OD techniques or building better internal relationships between departments, or maybe it's an awareness information communication problem. We can measure the difference. Is teamwork better? Is productivity up? Are defects down? We do it right here. But in order to do that, we really need to know where people are coming from, what their motivations are, how they're likely to respond to certain stimuli. That's the first postulation. The second one is that theory is okay. Theory is really okay. You know, public relations people are so anti-theory, it just boggles me. They asked me to start doing this seminar that Bob mentioned at the PRSA conference. When I was president of PRSA, I got tired of going to all those conferences where you sat there and listened to some media guru tell you something you knew 4 years before he ever heard of it. And if you're sharp in our business at all, you should know those things 4 years before those folks know, if they know at all anyway. And so we started doing these professional development courses, and I was asked to toss one in on theory. And I figured, well, that'll be great. I can probably read, you know, the paper all morning. It's been interesting to me, the response of people. The attendance has been excellent. But it's also interesting to me, the attitude that people bring to this. Because we really, you know, boy, we're can-do types. I mean, we're right down there where the rubber meets the road. Don't give me any of that theory. Isn't that what you say? Look, I don't want to know the theory. I just want to know, how can I do it effectively? Well, one of the great psychologists of our era, fellow who founded the Gestalt movement, has a phrase that we should all engrave into our brains. He said, there is nothing as practical as a sound theory. There is nothing as practical as a sound theory. Then he went on to explain why. Because if you can't explain it theoretically, he points out, you can't explain it at all. The only way you can explain it is, well, I think, and no manager I've ever met worth his or her salt cares what I think. What they're interested in is, what do you know? What have you observed in a scientific enough way that you can say, here's a postulation, here's a theory? Engineers, architects, lawyers, they don't work on that kind of theories, the I think kind of theory. They've got a body of built-up experience, of cases, of research, and that's what theory is. What theory is doing, however, as we start learning it, as we start going by the book, you know, instead of shooting from the hip, because that's a typical public relations response, right? Somebody brings us a problem, and we kind of lean back in our chair, and we say, well, let's see, I'll have a creative solution. Well, we're going around calling ourselves professionals, and then I look at the other professionals, doctors, for example. I don't want any doctor practicing any creative solution on me, okay? I want him to have some theory, some cases that says that you cut right here. You don't kind of say, well, let's see, left, right, let's see. We don't want that. Well, we don't need it either. So theory means that public relations can become a behavioral science. Now, don't worry about it. That isn't going to stop the creativity in the field, because when you're trying to deal with humans and get them to build relationships and overcome abuses and fight it out on issues as if they were indeed solid citizens and ladies and gentlemen, there'll be plenty of room for creativity. The difference is, if we apply science to our work, then all of our energies are freed for that kind of necessary creativity, because we know what's happening, we know how to do our work without having to be creative about that. When Bacon inaugurated the modern idea of science at the end of the 15th century, he said that science is nothing more than knowledge gained through observation and study. Observation and study. It seems to me, therefore, that every public relations practitioner I have ever known is a scientist. Because what do? We observe what's going on, and we study it carefully before we do our work. Well, if we can then build into our own observation and study the thousands of years of collective observation and study of our peers, of scholars looking at our field, it's clear that we are scientists. And if we are willing to accept that, you can see again how research plays an important part, because the basis of science is observation and study, which is another way of saying research. The third postulation is that a practitioner today has a very, very broad scope of responsibilities. It seems to me there are about six roles, in fact, that we have, and I want to just zip through these. This is Jackson's opinion. You may discard it instantly, but think about it and maybe make your own list, because I have a hunch we're not all in agreement of just what our responsibilities are. The first thing we are, and that's what we're here for to talk about today, is researchers. We have to get the data, whether we gather it ourselves, pick it up from secondary sources, retain someone else to get it. Now, if you are the keeper of the data, then you also had better be a strategic planner, because otherwise someone else is going to do the strategic planning based on your data. And so while we may not do the strategic planning for the whole organization that we represent, we ought to have a pretty large voice in that, simply because in today's world we all know that the human environment shapes that organization more than any other single factor by many times over. And certainly we have to do strategic planning for our own public relations activities. The third thing, see if I can get this all down here. The third thing that we are is educators. Because once we have a strategic plan, we then need to educate the other people in our organization to the need for that plan, how that plan is going to roll out, and what their responsibilities in it are. You know, we're pretty arrogant in public relations anyway, in a funny kind of a way, because one of our standard phrases is, we say, well, you know, I handle the public relations for Chrysler. I love that. I got it right here. I got it right here. I can handle it. The truth is, I think more and more we're learning that all that wonderful stuff that we put out for our managements that comes down from the ivory tower really isn't public relations at all. Public relations for an organization, as we know, is built where the rubber meets the road, where every member of that organization meets all their friends, acquaintances, customers, and other people. It's right down here. And that's why more and more when you look at organizations that have problems, it's because the ivory tower is sending out all these wonderful publications and ads and releases and so forth. But of course, nobody believes those because they come, you know, from officialdom. Instead, we go and ask some guy who works on the shipping dock, hey, what's it really like there? And he says, is anybody listening? Let me tell you. And of course, does. Tells it just like it is. And if those two messages are inconsistent, bingo, we're in big trouble. Well, some of you, or a few of you maybe, may have started life as teachers, and you may not like this idea. But we're the ones that have to educate everybody in one clear voice what the values of the organization are and all those other things. We're also counselors, because it's wonderful to do all those things, but of course we do have to counsel our fellow managers and get them to buy into the strategic plans and the organizational activities that we think are important. Fifthly, and I want you to note particularly that I put it way down here, we are, it's true, communicators. We're supposed to be the experts, as a rule, in our organizations in communication. If we have a problem, it may be that some of us start here. And if you start here, now we're really talking about shooting from the hip. Really talking about shooting from the hip. There's something else we are. You won't like this, but I got to tell you anyway. We probably, in most organizations, are the cheerleaders. Or if we aren't, we better jolly well know who is and get them empowered. Now, I know you look at that list and you say, holy Moses, you know, I came here thinking I was a five, and here comes this guy Jackson to tell me I got to be all six of those things. It's unfair. Unfair? Listen, in my town, the Catholic Church plays bingo in Latin, so us Protestants can't win. So that's so much for unfairness in our world. The fourth postulation I think you really need to investigate if you want to truly apply research meaningfully to your work is sort of the first test for any practitioner or any manager at any level, and that is this. Am I going to choose to work with the real world of human nature over here, people as they really, truly are, with all the pluses and all the minuses? Or am I going to choose to work in this dream world up here of people who are rational and logical and understanding and who read all my messages? We smile, but the fact is, most of us are working up here. Proof. Something doesn't get done, what do we say? But I sent the memo. See, I sent the memo. I mean, how come it didn't get done? Naturally, it was received, read, understood, acted upon. There was nothing else going on over there that might interfere. No attitudinal barriers. Pretty typical, pretty typical. So I think we have to buy into human nature. And the reason that's critical for research is that most research done in the name of public relations ignores it. It crunches numbers so much that it crunches people. And we got to be very, very careful of that. Well, buy in or don't buy in, you can sit there and be skeptical if you want. I realize that every message is countered by some attitude or some other message, and I'll try and persuade you on all this before I'm finished. But it seems to me if we can take a careful look at those four postulations, we're now ready to really dig into some of these basic questions about what research is. First, I think we need to back up a little bit and say, okay, how do we learn about this? And interestingly enough, we learn about all this, of course, through research. In this case, scholarly or case study research. And if you look at the case study research on public relations, it's kind of a brief view of our history. And it also begins to tell us what do we need to know and how can we find it out. The story really goes back to 1936. You all remember FDR was running for re-election, remember? And the Republicans put up this guy Alf Landon against him from Kansas. Well, in those days, the best we knew was that society looked like this sociologically. It was a class, pyramidal society, and all of the opinion leaders and the movers and shakers were up here. In those days, they were apt to be the teacher, the lawyer, the business owner, probably the preacher. Doctors weren't in it yet. They didn't even have one Mercedes, to say nothing of three. And these folks made up their minds, and then they kind of trickled down their opinions. It was a trickle-down theory of opinion leadership. Now, why was it true? It was true because in those days, all the rest of us here worked 6 days a week. It was only in the 30s we started getting Saturday afternoon off, maybe, in some industries. And on Sunday, you went to church twice and sat home, you know, like good boys and girls the rest of the day, because that was the social norm. And so the result was only a few people in society had the time or the information to make decisions, because we didn't have the over-communication that we have today. We didn't even have adequate communication. And so these folks that had the time and the information made decisions and kind of trickled them down over the rest of us, and those became public policy. Now, comes the election of 36. Roosevelt, you remember, was a person who was rich and socially prominent and who spent his presidency caring about people who were not rich and not socially prominent. And so these people called him a traitor to his class. Remember that? Naturally, when the election came around, if you went out and asked somebody who's going to win, your chances were you were going to ask these people. And of course, people did ask those folks. They said, well, Landon is going to wipe Roosevelt away. In fact, both Elmo Roper and George Gallup were doing their initial work in the 1936 election, and that's what they found out, that Landon was going to win. The leading news medium of the time was a wonderful weekly called the Literary Digest. That tells you something, doesn't it? Can you imagine floating one of those out there today? Guess I'll launch the Literary Digest. 2 weeks before the election, its cover said, Roosevelt will lose. Landon will win over Roosevelt in a landslide. Came the election, you know what happened. It was the exact reverse. Roosevelt won over Landon in a landslide, and so everybody went back to the drawing board. This was out. The sociologists made a new picture of our society, and they said, excuse me, it looks like this. There are classes and groups and subclasses and all this, and every one of them has their own opinion leaders. Opinion leaders are no longer folks up there. They're people all the way spread through society. Sounds commonplace to us, doesn't it? But it wasn't commonplace then. Our society did change during the decades of the 20s and 30s to represent this. So right away, and this picture is still true, it'll probably become more true according to the sociologists, as we become an ever more self-driven democratic society. So right away we know that one of the key research factors is who are those opinion leaders and how can I find out? Because everything we know tells us that they, more than anything else, set the standards, make the decisions. Other people tend, through peer grouping, to go along with them. So we know right away from 1936, you got to find out who the opinion leaders are. Anybody in the room that doesn't have a media list, raise your hand. Anybody in the room that doesn't have sharply defined opinion leader lists on every public, raise your hand. Come on, be honest. I think the rest of you are probably prevaricating, but we'll let you get away with it. We are wasting our time, friends, with media lists much of the time, and we don't even have opinion leader lists. We'll talk about that later. Everybody else had to go back to school, too. The communications theorists went off to Yale and started doing the Yale communication studies, about which I trust you've all read. And what they found was that the prevailing theory until that time was hokum. That theory was called the bullet theory. The bullet theory was based on the postulation that there is inadequate information in the world, and so therefore, if you can just shoot that information out there like bullets and hit people, they would immediately say, wow, why didn't I think of that sooner, and change their minds to conform to the information. Now, we should have known that that sort of defied human nature, but studies in the period seemed to show that it was correct. So suddenly, the bullet theory's out. We shot all that information out there. All the talk around the 36 campaign was Roosevelt's going to lose, and he didn't lose. In fact, he didn't lose by such a margin that this is out the window. Now, the communication scholars had a very hard time, because studies then immediately began showing that information, communication, has no power whatsoever. Did you hear that? No power whatsoever, in most cases, to mold people's attitudes or opinions, to say nothing of touching their behavior. Communication is almost worthless, is what was found in the late 30s, through the 40s, through the 50s. It wasn't until the 1960s that we were able to get cases that you could analyze in a scholarly fashion to show that communication had any direct effect. Those studies, surprisingly, were funded by the U.S. government. Public relations has got one or two things for our tax dollars. The subject was seatbelt usage, and the scholar was a guy named Everett Mendelson at the University of Denver. Department of Transportation asked Mendelson to say, look, we've spent all this money telling people, wear your seatbelts, wear your seatbelts, wear your seatbelts, and they're not wearing them. How come? So Mendelson did a massive study, and what he found was that communications can succeed if they are tightly linked to research. Again, research. Now, what did he mean by that? He meant two things. On the personal level, on the level of the audience, the Mendelson effect goes like this. It isn't enough to send people a message. You have to send them a message that gets them involved in some action. Now, notice, I'm not saying that they have to respond by doing what you say. It's not that kind of action. We can't expect that. It's just that you need to put them through some kind of process where they have to do something. And so Mendelson took the seatbelt material, and he changed it around to certain kind of games and questions. Because what he found was this, that if you said to people, wear your seatbelts, they said, why, I'm a safe driver. So instead, you had to send them a message that raised the question about those other guys who weren't safe drivers, and what would you do if one of them was coming straight at you? Okay? And so people had to go through this exercise, and that meant we had to know, first of all, how many people thought they were safe drivers, where were they, why did they think so? So we could send them this other message, which forced them to put themselves in the driver's seat without their seatbelts, and here comes the truck. Okay? And then the difference about, hey, if I had my seatbelt on, if I didn't have my seatbelt on. That was the first thing he found. The second thing he found was that public relations people have overemphasized the idea of a theme to a campaign. You know how it is. We all spend 6 months dreaming up just the right theme, and then we pound it, absolutely pound it, into the public. Now, why do we do that? We do that because we know that Joe and Jane Sixpack won't hear it the first 3,000 times. So maybe 3,001 will grab them. But we're overlooking something. Joe and Jane probably won't hear it. They may never hear it, for reasons we'll explain later. But these people probably hear it the first or second time. So by pounding the theme, pretty soon the opinion leaders who really make the decisions are going, you know, God, I'm so tired of that. But don't take my word for it. Have you ever watched the late night movies? How often do they run the same damn commercial? What do you say the second and third time? Get me out of here. That's what the public says, according to Mendelson's research, when we keep hammering them with the theme. So he said you got to use the theme differently. You use the theme like a graphic logo type. It's just a little repeated line of poetry, if you will. You may start out pounding it, and then you retire it to just a little piece of the logo. And what you do instead is you do continuing research on the public or publics that you're working with, and you constantly change the message to go with that. Interestingly enough, we didn't have a lot of public relations cases until about 3 years ago, when a good practitioner, some of you may know, in Columbus, named Mike Lors, was asked by the Columbus School Board to find out how come they lost the last three bond elections, and how could they win the new bond election. I think they lost the last one about 3-1. So Mike took Mendelssohn's theory to heart. He set up a continuing research activity. So they started out with the theme, and then they had a couple of weeks when they hit on point number one, and then they researched. And they found out how many people have gotten this message, and now what are their questions? Where have their interests moved with the passage of time and other things happening in the environment? When they got that data back, they changed the message to go with that. It's a kind of a gyroscope system. It traces where the public is on the topic at the moment and changes the message to go with that. So we're truly addressing where people are now, not where we were because of our theme statement. The result was that with no changes at all except in the technique of the campaign, that bond issue passed by 3-1. At almost the same time in Orlando, Florida, Barbara Fingerman was conducting a campaign for the local utility, which happens to be municipally owned, which means it's hated even worse than most utilities to start with, and she got similar results simply by every 2 weeks checking where the audience was and speaking to those issues instead of saying what the utility wanted to say. They said what people were asking. Sounds very simple, but we haven't done it. So Mendelssohn came along and showed us again how important research is on where the public's current position is on any issue. There's been another step since. You may just be interested in it. It's Jim Grunig at the University of Maryland was asked to take a look again by good old Uncle Sam at a similar subject to seatbelts, namely drunk driving. How come after all this publicity, people still drive drunk? What Jim came up with, all I asked Jim to do was to review all the communications theory and all the behavioral science research since time immemorial. So in a couple of weeks, he did that. And then he came up with some tests that have now given us a model for mass behavior change, a model proven several times since to work. Let me just share it with you. This is research of a different kind, but you may find it interesting. And if you're dubious that behavior can be our bottom line, the first step Grunig's research found is that there must be a campaign, an organized effort, so that the public or publics you're aiming at get the message, hey, this isn't going to go away. It's real. And a lot of important people or organizations are behind it. There are also three elements in that campaign. The first is problem identification, problem or opportunity identification. You've got to let people know, in the case of drunk driving, that it's a real problem. And until you've done that, don't worry about anything else. The campaign may take years just to get people to identify the problem. But until you can show through research that significant portions of the public, or at least of the opinion leaders of the public, because they're the ones who are going to make the decision, accept it as a problem, don't do anything else. That's first. Secondly, you've got to personalize the problem. I'm putting all this into English. If you get a copy of Grunig's study, you won't recognize those terms because, you know, he is a professor at the University of Maryland and he writes in that kind of language. What he meant by personify the problem was, as he put it, you've got to get an elderly teetotaling couple to understand that walking home from church at 12:30 on a bright, sunny Sunday afternoon, they may be run over by a drunk returning from Saturday night's party. Okay, in other words, worst case of people feeling safe, you got to show them you too. If you can do those two things, and by the way, Jim's research found that we were pretty good at that in public relations. But the third thing we didn't do, and that's what he called constraint removal, better known as you can do something about it. He says we're really good, we identify the problem, and we personalize it, and then we go away. And he said, it's worthless unless you say to him, here's what you can do about it. And so his studies show that drunk driving, oh, that's my shorthand. It says do something. S apostrophe T is something in Jackson's personal shorthand, because I never learned proper shorthand. The problem is, he says, people then they bail out because they say, well, I can't do anything about it. It's really awful, but I can't do anything about it. And so they go away. So we need always, according to him, give them something to do. If the campaign gets rolling along and you think you're scoring on those points, then you move to the next point. The next point is punishment of some sort. It's Platonic theory that you let people know, hey, if you do drive drunk, we're going to sock it to you. Stop and think for a minute now of what's happening in the current drunk driving campaign following Jim's model. First, big campaign. Mad, sad, the whole business. Government, brewers, hard liquor manufacturers, all on the campaign. Then they go to the judges and they say, hey, stop this wrist slapping, sock it to them, a year in jail. Then they run to the legislature and say, make it mandatory, a year in jail. Okay, then they've all moved on to step three, which is engineering. You try and engineer around the problem. So all those people now have joined forces with the mandatory seatbelt and airbags people, and they're trying to get laws enacted so that even if people don't pay attention to the drunk driving messages, don't fear the punishments, maybe we can engineer around those who won't. And then the fourth step is you have to make the idea totally a matter of social acceptance. Now think about the drunk driving campaign. Oh, 4 or 5 years ago, it was okay. You came into work on Monday morning, and you said, boy, I really tied one on Saturday night. God, you should have been at that party. And everybody says, yeah, gee, I'm sorry, I missed it. Try that today. People look at you and say, you jerk. What is the matter with you behaving like that? Think about this seriously. In 4 or 5 years, this change has occurred in America's social attitudes. The U.S. Forest Service wondered if this was reality, and so they applied it to a problem they had. They have a lot of fires that are started by campers who, you know, cook up their lunch, and then the sparks burn down the forest. So they put Smokey the Bear to work overtime. Then they got Congress to give a $10,000 fine or 2 years in jail to anybody who starts a fire, and they put up big signs at the campgrounds when you check in telling you, at some of the campgrounds they give you a little brochure that shows this guy behind bars and all that kind of stuff. Thirdly, however, knowing human nature, then they went and built 5-foot concrete pads around the fire sites to try and engineer around it. And then fourthly, at the larger campgrounds, a ranger comes around about dusk and he gathers up 3 or 4 of the people and their parties there, and they all sit around a campfire, and then he tells them about how awful the fires are for the animals and the birds and all the damage it does in order to get social acceptance. 2 years after starting the campaign, the Forest Service reported a reduction in those kind of fires of 90%. So I think we have some fair to middling evidence that this kind of thing works. My point simply being that in all of these, the key ingredient is research. Research is where it's at. So let's take a look at what research really is. And that leads me back to my point about us being confused. The politicians and the pollsters like to think that research is a predictive tool, right? This is where the people are, and so that's where they're going to go, and so my campaign is going to emphasize these points. It's better known as pandering. Pandering. Politicians use research to pander. Public relations people who do that risk a great deal. First of all, they certainly risk the reputations of their organizations 9 times out of 10. And I think the marketing people are misleading us even worse. There's an awful lot in what they say. I mean, they should know. We taught them to begin with. But aside from that, we have to be very careful to know the difference between pandering on the one hand and advocating a set of values on the other. As Scott Cutley points out, this kind of research never was intended to be and never can be a predictive tool. By the time you do the research, tabulate it, and issue the report, remember, it's already historic. That's last week, last month, 6 months ago. What it is a guide. Research has only one goal, and that is to add precision to decision. It is a guide. It is at its very best only a model of reality. So for heaven's sakes, don't let us as practitioners or our management let the research tell us what to do. Research without judgment is useless, because the world has changed since you took the research. New events have occurred. People's opinions, attitudes, behaviors are in flux. So we need to remember that. And the politicians and the pollsters don't want us to think so. Stop to think for a minute. A few years ago, the pollsters' roles in political campaigns was just to do the research. Now, generally, they're setting the message themes. They've practically, public relations people, most of them have backed out of political campaigns. Not only because you never get paid or get paid for what you did. You know, no one can pay you for the hours you have to work if you've never had a political client. Let me assure you of that. See, I have a lot of experience in that, and I really, whenever I give a speech, I always like to thank all of you. I come from New Hampshire, you know, and I want to thank you for letting us elect a president every 4 years. We appreciate that honor. The result of all this is that we get to see all the candidates in our firm, because we sort of are the firm in that part of the country, and so they all parade through. That's why I don't vote. You know, it really turns you off on politics when you have to see all those people. Actually, I do vote, but the pollsters now are almost trying to get as much publicity for themselves as for the candidates. Have you noticed that? Now, is that the way a professional functions? Not in my book, it isn't. They have taken this data that they have, tried to translate it into being public relations professionals. And believe me, they know zip about it. They think the bullet theory is still alive. Well, read the papers. Read what's happening in Washington, and you'll have some pretty good evidence of that. Let's not us be confused. Now, the professors, what are they doing to us? Here's what they're doing to us. Probably not intentionally. They're giving us the impression that research is always statistically pure based on a blind sample. Yeah, blind samples are just that, blind. A blind sample is wonderful if you know absolutely nothing about the subject or about the audience and you want to go out there and find out. Then a blind statistical sample has a lot of validity. Most of the time, for public relations purposes, that kind of formal academic research is totally unnecessary and indeed overkill and worse, very misleading. Because it's what leads people to believe that research is concrete. It's not just a model of reality, it is reality. Go ahead and act on it.